paperwork that ties you to the ranch. Even if he does go there, even if he comes with federal cops, you are safe. Hall shouted now, the first time Cage had ever heard him doing so. Not if he's there on the property when they come! To this, Cage said, Calm down, Sean. Look, the feds can't touch me, we all know that. I'm too important to them. I want to go to the property tonight, Jesus. After what I went through a couple of nights ago, I need it. Your men, Yako's men, the Mexicans at the ranch, you'll all keep me safe. Cage smiled a little. Won't you? Hall said nothing. He only looked at Yako. Won't you? Cage demanded. Of course, sir, Hall replied. Sean Hall pulled the icy bottle of Grey Goose from his freezer, yanked off the lid, then took one long, hard swig. Wincing with the sting of the alcohol, he walked to the front window of his residence and looked outside at Cage's mansion, just 75 feet away, across the pool. This is bullshit, he told himself. He looked down at his phone for a moment, saw he'd gotten a text from Cage's oldest daughter, Charlotte. The two of them had planned to go surfing the following morning, but she'd backed out in favor of spending a couple of days with friends at Lake Arrowhead. He started to read her text, but movement on the patio diverted his attention. Yako Verduren walked in Sean's direction, through the manicured gardens, and then across the patio. Bullshit, he said aloud now, and he put his phone back in his pocket, then swigged more of the frigid alcohol. He let Yako in a moment later, still holding the bottle, and this wasn't lost on Verduren. Drinking by noon. On the job, aren't you? Fuck you. Hall took another swig. Verduren sighed. Look, you're right. Gentry will find the ranch. But that's a good thing. I can end this, once and for all, as soon as he shows. But to do that without risking Cage, I need you watching over him and supporting my mission. What are you talking about? Verduren said one word. Maya. Hall cocked his head. The Romanian? What about her? Gentry is after her. This entire fucking thing, all the fighting and dying and burned down way stations, it's all about that one little bitch. Hall was confused. How do you know this? I know, Verduren replied, but said nothing else. Now the American security agent sat down on his sofa, his eyes distant. Does Ken know this? No, and you're not going to tell him. Why not? Because I'll look bad. And if you make me look bad, I've got more than enough on you to make you look very bad. Hall just stared up at the bald South African. Verduren continued. You accused me of using the director as bait over in Italy. Maybe I'm guilty of that, but it was a reasoned calculation that you could protect him while I killed off Gentry. My boys didn't get the job done there, so now we're here. This time, Maya is the bait. I've got my men at the ranch surrounding her. I'm going there myself and will be lying in wait. When Gentry comes, we'll be ready. Hall looked down at the rug between his feet. Why not tell Cage to stay away until that happens? Because I'll have to tell him why. If Cage finds out Maya's radioactive, he'll have me kill her. And then who knows if the Gray Man will continue the hunt? No, she has to stay alive for now.
And after?
After? After? I'll tell Cage myself that she was the one who caused all this shit. Make it look like I just found out. Don't worry about anyone else coming looking for that little whore. When Gentry is dead, when she's dead, then this little problem will be sorted.
Hall put the lid back on the bottle. Then he nodded slowly. This was Verduren's operation, Verduren's mess. He shook away the cobwebs the vodka was laying in his brain and stood up. Fucking kill this guy, Yako. Verduren nodded curtly, turned, and left the pool house.
47. Roxana Vaduva sat on a small love seat in her room as the light faded outside, and she stared down at her hands. She was alone now. But an hour before, an Asian woman who either spoke no English or else pretended like she didn't arrived without warning and painted Roxana's fingernails and toenails in fire engine red. This came after evening wear had been selected for her, after she'd been told to bathe thoroughly, and after a stylist had arrived to straighten her brown hair. This was Roxana's second day at the ranch. The evening before, she'd remained in her room because Dr. Claudia had told her that while she was free to roam the interior of the house during the day, she would not have any duties herself on her first night, so she should stay away from the guests.
Duties and guests.
Roxana had thought at the time the words to be sickeningly euphemistic.
Duties and guests.
Tonight's attention, the nails and the makeup and the clothing and the hairstylist, she took to be a very bad sign. Last night, Roxana had taken her dinner in her room, but still she heard men arrive, usually in groups of two or four, for hours and hours. She pictured the other women and girls on the property. Imagine they were all dressed up like she herself was now, and she had no doubts at all about what had happened on the other side of her closed door. There were no clocks in the building that she had seen during the early afternoon day when she'd spent a half hour walking around, looking out the windows, trying desperately to figure out where exactly she was. She'd made some light conversation with a few of the girls, as well as a woman Claudia had introduced who called herself Patty. Claudia said Patty was the coordinator, and Roxana took this to mean she was the madam, here to make sure the men who arrived to be serviced by the girls got what they came for. The guards around the building were mostly Latino, and while they eyed the girls up and down, they did not speak to them directly. There were also several well-dressed Caucasian men she took for South African here, and one or two of them she remembered from the night she was transported to the yacht that took her to Venice. She had yet to see the man called Yako since she'd gotten off the Gulf Stream the day before, but she could feel his ominous presence in the other men, all of whom had hard edges to them. Dr. Claudia entered Roxana's room just after 8 in the evening. She was dressed in a business suit, not like the gown Roxana was wearing or those she'd seen on the other women. She spoke in a calm voice, the words coming out through her practiced smile.
Tonight is the night, Maya.
Meaning?
The director is coming up this evening just to see you. You should feel very honored.
The 23-year-old Romanian nodded absently.
Remember, Claudia said, Yako is watching you very carefully. Don't cross the director and don't cross Yako. And all the good things that I've been promising you for the last several days will be yours.
The doctor left the room. Roxana's heart began to pound in fear, but she also saw this as an opportunity. If the director was coming here into her room, then there was a good chance his phone would be with him. And even if she didn't know where she was, she could call her sister, make some sort of contact, and describe everything she knew about this property and the people around her. She could describe the little part of the airport property she saw and the drive north and the ocean and the landscape, and maybe, just maybe, it would be enough to help. She knew Tom's arrival would present an opportunity, but that wasn't the chief emotion she was feeling right now. No, it was fear. Abject, unadulterated terror. She knew she was going to be raped. She could fight it. But she'd seen over a dozen armed men in the house so far, and she had no doubt they all worked for the director. If he attacked her tonight, he would have all the reinforcements he needed to exert his will. And how could she sneak his phone if she was in hand-to-hand combat with him around the room? The thought of killing herself returned for a brief moment, but she knew that wasn't going to happen. Part of her preferred death to what she knew was soon to occur, but another part of her wanted the pipeline exposed, no matter the personal cost. She wanted the director and Claudia and Yako stopped, and she knew that she, her sister, and the killer working with her sister were the best chances to make this happen.
The makeup artist entered the room and put her cases on the vanity next to her. Roxana did not speak to the woman. She did her best to hold in her fear, to concentrate on her task, and to try to get herself mentally prepared for the hell and for the opportunity that were both sure to come. I spend part of the day running simulated room clearing drills with Rodney and Kareem, the two men who will hit the house with me. Then the entire team, Carl included, sits with me in the little house in Bakersfield and pores over online overhead imagery of the property. We work out a myriad of different issues, and by mid-afternoon we have a plan detailing everyone's duties and responsibilities. It's a good team, and our confidence is high, even though we don't have anything resembling a solid exfiltration plan. I'm confident that we can overpower the opposition long enough for us to secure the hostages and grab some vehicles, but my confidence rests on Carl's flying skills and his ability to keep himself and Shep in the air, raining down merciless aggression on anyone who opposes us. It's 9 p.m. when we load up Shep's F-350 and Rodney's Ford Bronco, and then we head off towards the airport. It would be a pain in the ass getting onto the airport grounds in Bakersfield with all our weaponry, so instead we drop Carl off at the front gate of the fixed operating base where his Eurocopter is parked, so he can pre-flight the Hilo while the rest of us drive south. By 10, we're on the Golden State Highway, still wargaming different scenarios that may come up. I can tell these men have raided a lot of structures together over the years. They are cool and professional and, while they may not be in their prime from the standpoint of their physical ability, mentally, they are rock solid, and I know Hanley and Hightower hooked me up with the right group. I just wish there were 24 more of them, but when hitting a 15,000-square-foot building with an unknown number of hostiles inside and an unknown hostage disposition, I can get a little greedy. But despite the small force at my disposal, I'll take these guys into battle, and together, we'll do our best. At 11:45, the four of us are sitting in the bed of Shep's truck, looking at the cloudless sky, when AJ points out a speck of light approaching from the north. It takes minutes before we hear it, but by the time Carl brings the bird on final approach, we're all out of the truck, laden down with our guns and rucks. The helicopter lands in a field 50 yards away, and we start humping over to it. The four of us tasked with riding on the outside of the Hilo make uncomfortable eye contact. Carl is going to fly, lights out, to mask us visually, and low so we won't be heard from as great a distance. He's told us about his flight plan and the tactics he will employ, and none of us are thrilled about the prospect of racing 10 feet over the earth at 90 miles an hour, in the dark, hooked to the outside of a helicopter flown by a guy who, realistically, should be home watching TV and thinking of his glory days. But at this point, for all our reasons, we're pretty much committed to seeing this through. As promised, Carl has rigged 4 thick ropes, hooking them with carabiners to fixed points inside the cabin. The carabiner on the other end we each hook onto our utility belts. Then we check one another to make sure we didn't fuck it up. The doors have been removed from the Hilo, and our lifelines offer us just enough slack to stand on the skids and hold on to the door frames. If we fall from the skids, we won't drop to our deaths, but we will find ourselves dangling along, bouncing up against the fuselage of the helicopter, and praying Carl didn't go cheap and buy the rope holding us up at some dollar store in East Bakersfield. I push this out of my mind and notice 4 other ropes coiled on the floor inside the cabin. They're each 30 feet long, and they'll be tossed out before we get to our target, so we can fast rope down, just a couple dozen yards from the rear entrance. We considered a roof insertion of the property. The roof of the hacienda is flat enough, but we're worried about squirters, enemy slipping out of the property while we make our way down 3 stories. So we'll hit from the back lawn, clear together to the top, and kill anyone who opposes us. That's the plan, anyway. I hook onto the front port side, positioning myself right behind Shep and his SCAR 16S rifle in the front left seat. While the other men climb into position, I check my gear once more. I've got a nicely souped-up yet simple AK-47 pattern semi-automatic rifle. It's a big gun for close-quarters work, but it's proven itself over many decades of fighting around the world. and I know how to run it effectively with my eyes closed. I have 4 extra magazines in a rack on my chest, giving me 150 rounds total. The other guys are wearing body armor, but there aren't any extra plates for me. I'm wearing my pistol in a drop leg holster, and there is a trauma kit and a long fixed blade benchmade knife in a sheath on my belt. Rodney gave me 1 smoke grenade and 1 flashbang grenade, and they're both hanging from my chest, and I'm borrowing ear protection over my inter-team radio headset and ballistic goggles. I don't have a helmet. Rodney was fresh out of helmets, too. In a small backpack, I have extra pistol mags along with the Walther P-22 pistol and an attached suppressor, though I'm not sure how covert I'm going to need to be, considering we're all flying right up to the target in a helicopter. Still, you never know how tonight is going to shake out, so I like the versatility of a low-decibel firearm on my person, just in case. At midnight, Carl applies maximum power and the rotors battle the air a moment, and then we lift off the field for our 20-minute flight to the target, surrounded by a swirling cloud of dust. Instantly, my goggles are covered in the dust, and when I wipe it off, I see that the Vietnam vet pilot has already turned off all the lights on the aircraft. I look inside the open hatch and see him there, his craggy face glowing with the green light of the instruments in front of him. He doesn't have night vision goggles. He's just flying along low to the ground, picking up speed, and peering into the darkness ahead. Holy shit. I catch myself pining for the relative safety of the shootout at the other end of this flight. Surely it won't be as dangerous as the next 20 minutes. Ken Cage lay on the bed, his eyes on the ceiling, and he wiped sweat from his brow with a hairy forearm. His heart pounded in his chest. The angina burned. But he was used to this after 6. Next to him, his newest victim lay facing away from him, her naked body exposed, and he heard her soft sobs, like a punished child. This made him smile a little. He lay without moving for several seconds, then reached over and grabbed her by her hair, pulled her head back to him. She screamed in surprise, and their eyes met in the low light, inches apart. "Just so you know, I was easy on you tonight. Next time, you'll get to see my wild side." He rolled off the bed, pulled on his shorts, and headed for the door. "No, you didn't get the high-octane version of me because I saved my energy for the other new girl." He smiled again. "You can thank her in the morning." The director left the room without another word. The Hungarian girl called Sophia gazed blankly at the wall through tear-filled eyes. She'd been raped, and she'd been helpless during, and now that it was over, she felt just as helpless. She looked at a bar glass the director had left on the nightstand, half full of some brown liquid, and she wondered if she had the mental strength to shatter it in the bathroom, and then to slit her wrists. But she made no move towards it. No. She just lay there and wept. 48. Jaco Verdoorn had taken off his suit jacket and his tie, but his shoulder holster was in place over his dusty blue dress shirt, and his Sig Sauer pistol was snapped into it and ready for instant access. His feet were on an ottoman, and he reclined in a chair. At nearly midnight, he'd only just fallen asleep here in the library on the ground floor of the massive ranch house. He'd spent the evening positioning his own men as well as the Mexicans who were the regular security force here at Esmeralda. Everyone had been warned there were special threats here, and everyone seemed as ready as they could be. Mexican cartel soldiers were positioned on the large, almost flat roof of the hacienda-style building, as well as on the property all around, with many more on reserve, a half mile away at the eastern edge of the property. Verdoorn's own men were here inside the home with him, and he had them in cover. All 8 were dressed like the wealthy Johns allowed access to Rancho Esmeralda. They wore nice suits, expensive polos, or other casual clothing, and they bunked in a couple of the dozen or so rooms on the 2nd and 3rd floors normally used by the Johns and the whores. His boys wouldn't like this environment at all. They weren't security guards. They weren't here to police the Johns. They were hunters, enforcers for the consortium. But their ill ease was good as far as Yako was concerned. He didn't want them happy. He wanted them ready. Verdorn had steered clear of Sean Hall and his team of six security officers since they'd arrived here with Cage an hour earlier. They were all up on the third floor, in or around Cage's private apartment on the eastern side of the house, or else positioned around whatever room Cage was in, either enjoying one of his new arrivals or relaxing in the lounge off the entry hall, eating, drinking, and snorting lines. Yako dozed a little, but he'd spent the entire time here tonight wishing Gentry would just get on with it. He'd studied the way the assassin had ingressed to target on the few of his missions about which such details were known. He liked to move silently with stealth, cunning, and the tradecraft of the most elite assassin in the world. The South African fully expected Gentry to try to slip into this building unnoticed, and Verdorn and his men would be here to greet him, and then the Mexicans outside would close off any chance he had to escape. And Cage? As far as Verdorn was concerned, Ken Cage was Sean Hall's problem. Court Gentry was the real VIP. I try not to puke as our helicopter lurches up and down in the dark. Hanging on to the edge of the open hatch, I tell myself the fast food tacos we all ate on the drive down from Bakersfield were a bad idea, and AJ is an asshole for suggesting them. But Carl, on the other hand, is a damn fine pilot, and I can feel his skill in the movements of the helo. He has a deft touch to his pedal controls and his cyclic, and I know this flight, as jarring as it is, could be a hell of a lot worse. Eventually, I hear the power come off and then the aircraft slows quickly and pulls into a hover, yanking me and the other outboard guys forward. Then Carl descends the few feet to the earth and the skids touch down. Dust swirls all around the darkness, so I can't see a thing, but I know AJ is unhooking his carabiner and leaping from the skid on the starboard side of the aircraft, dropping down to quickly set up a shooting position, more than a half mile from the rear of the property. I know with our low flight and our distance that we still should be silent to our enemy, but once we get back up into the air and move forward a few hundred yards, that will no longer be the case. We're banking on the opposition not expecting us to hit tonight, via air, and with such force. If we're wrong, then we'll probably get blasted out of the sky before this party even starts, so I try not to think about that. I brush dust off my goggles again, and I look back inside the hatch towards the two men in the front seats. I can only see the back of Shep's head. He's leaning into the scope of his rifle, searching for targets on the roof of the distant building. Carl's wrinkled face, all the more wrinkled with the intensity of his focus on his windscreen and on the controls, is a mask of experience and determination. I recognize instantly that he is exactly where he wants to be, doing exactly what he wants, needs to be doing. For a brief second, I feel the same, but then my mind shifts back into game mode. As I watch, Carl looks back over his shoulder, takes his hand off his collective, and holds a single gloved finger up into the air. His voice crackles over the radio and into my ears.
1 minute out!
The entire team repeats the call into our mics, and then we bring our weapons to our shoulders and scan forward in the darkness as best we can. Here we go. Ken Cage stood in the bedroom, still in his boxers, still half covered with the sheen of sweat from his attack on the Hungarian girl 5 minutes before. In front of him, Maya stood nervously, her back to the wall, the black cocktail dress perfectly fitted to her perfect body. He'd done nothing to calm her nerves. "Take it off," he demanded. The Romanian hesitated, then said,
"Look, sir, I am..."
"Take it off,"
he shouted now. She did as she was told, stood naked before him, her jaw quivering, but her eyes remaining on his, fixed, proud. Afraid but resolute. Cage said,
"I'll finish the job Claudia couldn't manage on her own."
Maya asked,
"What job?"
The American smiled, dropped his boxers, the Viagra he took hours before still on duty.
He looked her up and down and said, I'll wipe all that delicious defiance right out of your soul.
He moved towards her with aggression, his eyes wild with intensity, and he shoved her back against the wall. Pressing his body against hers, he slipped a hand over her face and covered her mouth and nose. Behind Cage, the door flew open and Sean Hall rushed in, a walkie-talkie in his hand and an intense look on his face. He wore a white tank top undershirt and jeans, sandals on his feet, and his pistol was jammed into his waistband. Cage spun around, making no attempt to cover his manhood.
What the fuck, Sean?
Hall raced forward, pulled a robe off the footstool at the end of the bed, and handed it to his boss. He grabbed Cage by the arm, pulling him naked towards the door to the hall while a nude Maya spun away and raced for the bathroom. The bodyguard explained as the two men rushed into the hall.
External security says there's a helicopter inbound, flying over the rear of the property with no lights. Until it's ID'd, I'm moving you to a secure position.
Cage wasn't happy at all, but he knew it was best to comply. Hall tended to exaggerate threats, but Ken knew that bitching about it after the fact was the way to go. Fighting with him now would only delay the process and cause everyone more agitation, Cage included. As they ran, Cage threw his robe on and cinched the belt tight, and Hall brought his walkie-talkie back up to his mouth. But before he did so, the unmistakable booms of gunfire erupted just above their heads on the roof of the ranch house. More rifles outside at ground level rocked off fully automatic a second later. Hall kept Cage's pace up by squeezing his hand on his shoulder as they ran towards the stairs. While doing so, he said,
That's outgoing. That's our Mexicans. They've identified the Hilo as a threat. Move! Where's Yako?
Hall didn't answer. Instead, he shouted over his walkie-talkie to his men.
We're leaving! Get in the G-wagons!
Cage ran along, enraged that, for the second time in 3 days, he found himself fleeing for his life with a frantic bodyguard's hands all over him.
We're taking fire,
Shep said, and I hear him through the radio, but I also hear the supersonic crack of bullets zipping by the helicopter. Shep leans out of the opening next to him, his SCAR rifle positioned on a cable running midway across the hatch to serve as a shooting platform.
I've got targets on the roof,
he says, then begins firing slow, controlled shots. I can't see any targets yet, or even the target building, but AJ speaks up over the radio from his sniper's hide behind us.
Overwatch has targets on the property east side, ground level. Engaging now.
I can't hear AJ's sniper rifle, but I trust he's dropping some of the sons of bitches who are shooting at the aircraft I'm clinging to.
I'm still scanning for something to kill. I don't have any targets from my vantage point because Shep and his weapon are blocking my view in front of me. But I keep searching, hoping to see the telltale sparkle of a muzzle flash somewhere out there in the dark. Carl speaks up again.
Too much fire to land on the back lawn. I'm going over the target. We'll come back around and try it from the front.
I finally see a muzzle flash near a small pond behind the house now, and I fire a few rounds out of my AK towards the source. Then I say,
Negative, negative! Put Kareem and Rodney down on the roof.
What about you?
Shep asks.
Carl, can you throw me through a window on the third floor?
There is a pause. Through it, I hear Kareem firing on the other side of the helo. Carl replies,
You want me to do what?
I sling the AK to the side, muzzle down, and I throw out my rappelling line.
Fly exactly 30 feet above any top floor window on this side of the property. I'll lower down the rope, and you fly me right through the glass. I'll link up with the other two as able.
Carl answers me back quickly as he slows the helicopter.
How do I know exactly 30 feet? You'll get me close enough.
I hear him sigh through the radio.
I can do that, but you've only got 15 seconds to get in position. Copy,
I shout. And then I unfasten my carabiner with my left hand, grab the rappelling line with both arms and legs, and begin sliding down, almost uncontrollably fast. More gunfire, both incoming and outgoing, hammers the air around me, and then I hear a new sound, a pounding, jarring series of thuds. Carl says,
Taking hits!
And then,
We're continuing!
Shep's rifle booms and booms above me. I draw the Glock from its drop leg holster, sight it on the window not 30 feet in front of me now, and, while still trying to slide down the rope, I fire two rounds into the upper portion of the glass. It's at a small upwards angle, so I'm not worried about shooting a hostage, and breaking the glass is worth any small risk, because solid windows aren't much fun to dive through.
I know this from experience, of course. 2 seconds later, I let go of the rope, curl myself into a ball, and impact the damaged window at 25 knots because Carl has slowed to land on the roof. I fly in surrounded by shattered glass and shredded curtains. My hearing protection and goggles fly off, and I tumble through the air. I tuck in tight, expecting a jarring crash onto the floor, but instead, I bounce on something soft, roll end over end, my rifle's polymer buttstock knocking me in my mouth as I tumble. And then, somehow, I end up on my boots in an uncontrolled run. Above me, the helicopter hovers over the roof, and gunfire continues all around. I stumble across a room and finally do bounce against a wall, slamming my shoulder hard and dropping the Glock. I miraculously keep my feet, then turn back around and heft my rifle on its sling. Yeah, I do all my own stunts. I see what happened immediately. I came through the window, hit a king-sized bed in a large bedroom, and then momentum shot me back up and all the way to the far wall. As I look around, I see the bed is unmade and there is a smell of candles in the air, and once I realize there are no threats present, I pick up the pistol and slip it back in its holster. Stealth mode, I tell myself, has been disengaged since I alerted anyone in the area by crashing through the glass. Moving to the door, I'm slightly dazed, and I feel blood on my lips, but it's nothing I'm not used to. I'm operational as long as I have breath in my lungs and brain function, and I'm trained not to slow down for injuries that aren't disabling. Before I get to the door, I hear running just outside. I step behind the door as it flies open, and I see a man with dark curly hair enter with a black AR-15 up at his shoulder. He scans the room, and I wait patiently behind him, wondering if he has any buddies following. But when I don't hear other footsteps after a moment, and the man begins to turn back around, I fire once into the side of his head. Blood ejects out his temple, and he drops 10 feet away from me. I fire once more into him as I spin out of the room into the hallway. Rodney's voice is on the radio now, just audible through the gunfire raging outside.
All hostiles on the roof are down. We're entering via the stairwell, west side of property.
AJ speaks up next.
I've got inbound forces, 2 Vics leaving the bunkhouse, unknown number of hostiles. They loaded up the trucks out of my field of vision. They'll be on your paws in under a minute unless I can slow them down. We'll advise.
Shep transmits, the thumping rotor pounding through my earpiece.
Harry, you inside, or did you hit the wall?
I respond softly, not sure what threats lie ahead. I'm in. Keep up that air cover as long as you can.
Roger that,
Shep says. I call to AJ. Overwatch, I need you to buy us some time with the hostile QRF. It's going to take a while for 3 dudes to clear this place and organize the hostages. AJ replies coolly.
I'll see what I can do, targeting the engine blocks on the trucks.
I push the worry about the enemy outside of the house from my mind, and I focus on the enemy inside with me now. Moving up the well-lit passages with my rifle optic to my eyes, I see door after door in front of me, like a hotel hallway. The door just ahead on my right opens, and without a moment's hesitation, I lunge at it, impact the person on the other side, and push them up to a wall. It's a young woman with blue eyes filled with terror. I hold my gloved left hand over her mouth while she deals with the shock of everything that's happening around her. She's wearing a t-shirt and panties. Her sandy brown hair is pulled back in a ponytail, and it appears as if she's just taken a shower. It's not Roxana, and I have no idea if I saw this woman in Mostar or not. Leaning close to her, I say, English? When she nods, I ask, how many guards? I take away the hand, and she speaks with a pronounced accent, which I take to be Czech.
I don't know. Many. And new men here, white men. Maybe 7, 8. They have guns. They dressed like Johns.
How many Johns are here now? Again, she says,
I don't know. Not many, maybe 5.
I transmit quickly to Kareem and Rodney. Be advised, enemy personnel mixed in with the Johns. Treat every male you see as potentially hostile. Rodney responds,
this ain't our first rodeo, Harry.
These are the guys who gunned down over 12 traffickers in Manila. They don't need me telling them to keep their weapons at the ready. I stop transmitting and try to extract more target intelligence from the woman in front of me. How many females here now?
9,
she says, and then she shakes her head.
No, 2 came yesterday. 11 now.
Where are they?
Most are on 2nd or 3rd floor, but some of the Johns take the girls to the grotto on the ground floor.
It's on the other side.
There might be girls there.
I need you to get dressed, then climb into the bathtub and wait for someone to come collect you.
Where are we going?
Her voice cracks with fear. You are going home. She looks at me with bewilderment.
You are the good guys?
To this, I only shrug as I turn away. We're more like the slightly better than them guys. I leave the room to the sound of her running on bare feet deeper into the room and, hopefully, to her clothes and shoes. Telling this girl I was going to get her home might have been a bit ambitious on my part, since me and my mates are probably outnumbered 4 or 5 to 1 right now. But hopefully, it will have the effect of getting her moving.
49. Roxana Vadova had run naked into the bathroom, and here she quickly dressed in warm-ups and a pullover that she'd left lying over the edge of the bathtub. When the gunfire began, she dove to the floor and covered her head, and then a helicopter chopped the night air right outside the bathroom window. She crawled to the door and locked it, but only seconds later she heard a man's voice.
Maya! Get out here!
It was Yako. He sounded breathless, excited, but not afraid. She looked at the locked door but didn't move towards it, hoping he'd go away. The South African's voice rang out again, but this time he was right outside the bathroom.
Open it now, or I'll kick the bloody thing down and wring your neck!
She unlocked the latch and opened the door. Yako reached in and took her by the arm, then yanked her out of the bathroom, out of the bedroom, and into the hall. The two entered the stairwell and Roxana struggled to keep up with the tall, bald-headed man. The gunfire outside was mixed in with the sound of the helicopter receding.
Where are we going?
She demanded. He kept rushing down the stairs, her wrist tight in his hand, and he said,
Not a word out of you or I'll break your jaw.
Roxana said nothing else. Yako took a radio off his belt as they reached the ground floor and began running through a large entry hall towards the front door of the house.
Lion One is exiting.
Roger,
came a reply from one of his men.
The heli flew off to the north. I think he landed. Can't see him.
Good, Yako said, because we're going south.
Sean Hall's voice came over the radio now.
I've got the director in one of the G-wagons. We're out of here.
Wait,
Yako demanded, then ran out the back door of the building with the girl in his grasp, a pistol high in front of him.
Carl banked sharply over the property to the east of the mansion, and Shep hung his upper torso out of the helicopter to line up his optics on a man racing up the drive on a four-wheeler with a rifle on his back. He took the shot, hit the four-wheeler, but not the man, then told himself he needed to concentrate his fire on a larger group of hostiles moving in from the east, because there certainly were plenty of targets. AJ came over the headset now.
Papa, the 2 QRF trucks are down. I put rounds through both engines, but the men are out moving on foot. 20 of them easy. I've lost them behind a hillock between me and them. You'll have to try and rake them before they get to the house.
Shep acknowledged, then spoke to Carl. The two men were sitting just feet apart in the helicopter. But the incredible noise of the machine meant they needed radio headsets to communicate.
Take us back to the west, low, slow, pass,
Carl said.
I'll give you low, or I'll give you slow, but you can't have both. We'll be a sitting duck. Low and fast, then. I've got to thin that herd. Roger that. Hang on for a yanking bank.
Carl pulled the stick hard, and the Eurocopter swung violently to the left. Shep aimed in on a group of flashes right where AJ directed him, and he squeezed off a single round, killing a cartel soldier with a shot through the stomach. He shifted fire to the right and sent another round into the foot of a second enemy, taking the man out of the fight. He poured rounds into the group as they flew 50 feet above the men, the sound of incoming gunfire cracking through the outgoing and the AS-350's engine and rotors. Shep transmitted as he aimed on another cluster, moving through thick brush off the dirt road.
Harry, be advised. Me and AJ are giving this QRF a bloody nose, but you'll still have a dozen or more men at the house in under 2 mics. There's too many of them, and...
Just then, accurate automatic weapons fire from the ground pounded the nose of the Hilo.
Pulling out!
Carl shouted, as glass and metal sprayed around the cockpit. He yanked the stick hard to the right now, sending the Eurocopter into another hard turn. Shep lurched to his right and then slumped back in his seat, his head down. The Vietnam veteran at the controls nosed his aircraft down to build speed and to flee the gunfire, and, as he concentrated on the dark landscape feet under his skids, he called out over the radio.
Papa is it! Papa is it!
Only when he leveled off did he look over to the big man next to him.
Shep had taken a rifle round through the throat, and blood spurted out over the controls on his side of the dash. He was ashen, and his eyes were closed, his arms at his sides, and his lifeblood poured from him.
Shep! Shep!
Carl tried in vain to get a response from the big man. Rodney and Kareem called over the radio, desperate for an update on their leader, but the pilot ignored them, because now his oil light flashed on his instrument panel. He had to land, but he also knew he needed to create more distance from the enemy before doing so.
Report status of Papa,
AJ demanded now.
KIA,
Carl replied, and then,
sorry, boys, and you've lost your air cover for now. AJ, I'm putting down about 200 yards west of you to check this out. You've got the fight on the outside now.
Roger that,
AJ replied before adding,
Harry, Kareem, and Rodney, the fuckers from the bunkhouse are heading your way.
Jaco Verdoorn made it to the row of three black Mercedes G-Class SUVs already idling in front of the house. Cage and Hall were in the second vehicle, with three of Hall's six men in the driver's seats of the impromptu motorcade, and one more in the front passenger side of each vehicle. Verdoorn opened the back door next to Cage, who was seated next to Hall. The South African all but threw Maya inside across from them.
What the hell is she doing here?
Cage screamed. Cage was panicking, and to Verdoorn, Sean didn't look much cooler.
Let's move it!
Verdoorn didn't respond to his boss. Instead, he looked to Hall.
Remember, she's the key.
She's the what?
Cage shouted. Hall nodded to Verdoorn, then turned to his protectee.
Sir, we'll talk about it on the drive. We have to get out of here before that helo circles back.
Verdoorn began closing the door, but Cage put his foot out to stop him.
Wait! You aren't coming?
Jaco turned around and looked at the house.
Gentry's here, boss. This is where I belong.
He shut the door to the G-Wagon and ran back towards the front door of the home.
I link up with Kareem and Rodney on the second floor landing in the center of the building. Both men report shooting two guards, meaning we've dropped five in total, and together we've found six women and girls, all of whom we've asked to shelter in place while we clear the area. The raid has been going on no more than a minute and a half, but I can see that both my teammates are gassed. Rodney put his hand out on a wall for a breather, and Kareem is wincing with each step.
You hit?
Hit by time, bro. Bad back.
Christ. He sees my concern as he begins reloading his rifle.
It's all about adrenaline now, anyway.
He snaps a fresh mag in and drops the bolt release.
Let's rock.
Rodney gets off the wall and we stack up in a three-man train, then begin heading down to the first floor. But before we can make it more than a couple of steps, a group of three armed Latino males spin into view below us. They're looking for threats, but they hesitate an instant as they size us up as targets. Kareem, Rodney, and I each fire a controlled double tap, two into each man, and all three tumble back down to the ground floor, dead. We start down again. But Kareem grabs me by the shoulder just as Rodney tosses a flashbang grenade past my ear. All three of us turn away as it detonates below us in the entry hall of the ranch house. We descend the rest of the way, where we stumble upon two white men in plain clothing on their hands and knees, disoriented from the banger. Kareem knocks them both flat to the floor while Rodney and I cover back up the stairs, as well as the ground floor hallways leading into both the east and west wings, and a doorway from the entry hall into the kitchen. The first man on the floor who Kareem checks is unarmed, but the other is lying next to a Heckler & Koch semi-automatic pistol, and under his coat, we can see the telltale imprint of a radio on his belt. Kareem says,
"He's hostile. What do I do with—"
Without speaking, I shift my AK and shoot the man once in the back of the head. We don't have time to give quarter to these motherfuckers. Kareem, who is now kneeling on a dead body, just says,
"Works for me."
And then he rises up and drops back down over the unarmed man, wincing with back pain as he does so. This civilian is in the fetal position. He's pissed his pants and he's crying like a baby. He's obviously expecting to lose his life, just like the man on the floor 6 feet away has. He is a John, a rapist, likely a pedophile, and my first inclination is to kill him. But he's not a threat to me. Kareem obviously gets it because he leans into the man's ear.
You lay your ass right the fuck here, face down, and don't move till you see daylight through that window, you feel me?
The man turns and presses his face into the floor, and he continues crying uncontrollably. The front door to the building flies open now, and the three of us find ourselves 20 feet away from multiple armed men. We shift aim to the doorway and open up in bursts, and the attackers dive from view. I don't know if we made any hits, but I'm pretty sure they weren't expecting to get shot at the instant they opened the front door, just a couple of minutes after we inserted on the roof on the third floor. They can't possibly know how many of us there are in the building. So I expect they'll take a minute or two to reassess the situation before making a second breach attempt. Rodney runs to the door, shuts and locks it, then reloads while Kareem and I cover the entire area. Another plain-clothed Caucasian, this one young and very fit-looking, steps into the entry hall from the kitchen on our right, and he raises his empty hands upon seeing us.
Shit! Don't shoot! Please don't shoot!
Kareem speaks softly to me. That ain't no John. Before either of us can react, however, the man drops hard to the wooden floor. Behind him, two more men, one Caucasian and one black, spin into view with HKMP7 personal defense weapons at their shoulders. I fire as Rodney dives for cover behind a massive planter by the front door. Kareem and I shoot the armed men, but both of our rifles run dry simultaneously. As we transition to our pistols, the man on the floor draws from his hip and aims our way. He gets off a single shot before Rodney rolls out from behind the planter and dumps a dozen rounds from his SCAR into the prone attacker, killing him instantly. I look next to me and see that Kareem is hit. His right shoulder glistens red, and he stumbles back a step but does not fall. He looks down at the wound.
Damn it!
He shouts in anger, but not in pain. I've been shot before. Pain comes later. I reach for the medical kit on his chest rig to patch him up, but he just shakes his head.
I'm good to go. First things first. We ain't got much time till those cartel boys bust back in. Rodney and I will get the girls together upstairs. You go check out that grotto. Roger.
I sprint off to the west side of the building, my rifle in front of me, as the two other men make their way back up the stairs. 50. Jaco Verdurn, White Lion 1, and Duncan Diker, White Lion 7, knelt in the kitchen with pistols pointed towards the doorway to the hall. They'd just seen three of their colleagues killed right in front of them, and the kitchen shot up around them, bullets from the entry hall tearing through everything in sight. They couldn't see the shooters from here because of the angle. Verdurn imagined the gray man and his cohorts were no more than 50 feet away from him now, but he wasn't racing into the fatal funnel of the doorway to find out. Diker turned to Lion One.
We thought we'd sneak in low profile, but he came in a fucking helicopter and he brought a platoon of men with him. Who does he think he is?
Verdurn boiled, angry at Gentry, angry at himself. He'd misjudged the American assassin, took his previous stealthy modus operandi as a predictor of his future actions, and now Jaco realized he'd paid a terrible price for it. He couldn't raise any of his men on the radio, and now it seemed likely that he, Diker, and Lutz, who had driven off with Cage, were all that remained of the original 10 White Lion men. Verdurn made a decision while still squatting behind the table.
We're getting out of here before the police come. We have to get the director out of the country till the heat from all this recedes. What about the Mexicans on the property? What about them? There's 25 of the bastards, or there were anyway. Let them take their best shot at Gentry and his mates.
The two South Africans backed out of the kitchen, their pistols still pointed at the doorway to the entry hall, and then they sprinted for the row of luxury cars outside, driven here from L.A. by the guests.
I find three young women in the grotto hiding behind a faux waterfall, one no older than 16. Four Johns, all of them unarmed, are with me. They're hiding too, and even more terrified than the hostages. I search the men quickly, then leave them behind as I lead the women to the main stairs. I don't like going back in the entryway. There are a lot of entrances to cover, but I don't see that I have any choice. As I advance carefully up the east wing hallway, one of the girls grabs me by the arm.
What? I ask, annoyed.
Where are we going?
Upstairs.
Wouldn't the back staircase be safer?
I spin around and reverse my direction. Hell of a lot safer. Show me where. We encounter one more hostel on the rear stairs, and I dump a half dozen rounds of 7.62 caliber into his back before he sees me. A minute after this, we are back on the second floor landing, looking down the main staircase at the entry hall and the front doors. Kareem and Rodney are with us now,
along with all the hostages they've rounded up. Roxana is not here. I call out to the group.
Who knows Maya?
One girl says,
The Romanian. I know her. I came with her yesterday.
What's your name?
Sophia.
She shakes her head, then says,
Nora. My real name is Nora.
Where is Maya now?
The hostages confer a moment, and then the girl from the grotto says,
The tall, bald man from South Africa dragged her downstairs and outside, just after the director left. I don't know where they went. I ran into the grotto.
Shit.
Yako must have fled with Roxana so he could use her as a bargaining chip. I start to turn away, but then spin back to her.
Wait. The director? He was here?
Nora says,
He's been here all night. They just drove away.
Unfucking real. It's just like Venice. I've missed this asshole once again.
I fight away the frustration and think about my predicament. The large enemy quick reaction force hasn't attempted another breach of the building. I know it's just a matter of minutes before they do. I hit the transmit key for my radio.
AJ, what do you see out there?
The team sniper responds quickly.
I can only see the back of the property. The QRF went around to the front 3 minutes ago.
I tap the push to talk button again. Carl, say status.
Oil leak is dealt with, not too bad. This bird will fly, but I won't want to do much in the way of acrobatics.
Rodney says what I'm thinking now. Harry, there are a lot of ways into this building. If 15 or 20 guys hit in a coordinated fashion, the three of us are going to get our asses overrun. He's right, of course. We can't hold back that entire force if they come hard from different directions. I decide to call Talissa to tell her that finding Roxana and the director is her responsibility, because I'm not making it out of here alive. But before I do, a statuesque blonde woman in an evening gown pulls on the torn arm of my tunic.
You think you men are the only ones who can fight?
I don't have time for this. What are you talking about?
I can fight too.
She looks like a 20-year-old fashion model, and I discount her immediately. I love this spirit, miss, but those guys out there are going to be Mexican cartel, and they know how to handle their weapons.
So do I.
Incredulous, I say. You can shoot an M4?
I've never tried.
I start to turn away. Yeah, let us handle.
But I can shoot your AK. I spent 2 years in the Ukrainian army.
I turn back to her, astonishment evident on my face. Doing what?
Infantry.
Karim hears this.
No shit.
She looks into my eyes and lifts her chin.
I can handle that rifle on your chest, but you won't let me because you men are too proud to...
I pull the sling over my head, removing the Kalashnikov from my body.
You've got me all wrong, sister. I couldn't be happier you want to fight. Hell, I'll let you run this shit.
I hand the weapon to her. She takes it, slings it around her neck, drops the mag to check the ammo, and then clicks it back into place. I look around to the 9 other women up here at the top of the stairs.
You guys got any handy skills?
3 hands rise. A woman tells me she spent 2 years in the Polish Air Force, where she learned basic firearms handling. Another, the 16-year-old I found hiding in the grotto, says her father is Bulgarian police, and she's probably shot a pistol as much as I have. She's wrong, but her attitude is right, so I pass her my Glock. Other women head off to pick up weapons and ammo from dead men on this floor. And soon, one brings me an AR-15 along with 2 extra magazines to replace the weapon I handed off to the tall Ukrainian. Rodney and I position our 4 new shooters behind cover, facing both wings, and Karim shows a few more how to handle guns while the first 3 keep watch down the stairs. The rest drag furniture out of bedrooms, sliding it across the floor. A dresser, a table, a TV stand. It's more concealment than it is cover, but it's something, and Rodney helps them line it all up on the stairs to provide cover from below. I radio AJ and tell him I have 9 guns in the fight now, and he responds by letting me know he's moving to Carl and the Hilo. It's the right call to shut down the sniper's hide at the back of the property and for the 2 of them to link up. We won't be flying 13 people out of here with a 4-seater helicopter, but when the time comes, one more low and fast pass with the Hilo and a rifle may help disrupt the enemy attack. It takes the cartel boys a few minutes to plan their second wave, but they do a decent job of it. First, the power goes out on the property, and then the front door opens again, while the shooting simultaneously begins from both hallways. But the enemy's advantage is greatly decreased by the fact that they have three narrow attack points, and we have three weapons pointed at each one. All nine of us fire like mad, dumping so many rounds downrange that it overwhelms the two or three men who can fit abreast at each attack vector. It's too dark to see who's getting hit, but our outgoing fire is awesome to behold. I lost my ear protection when I crashed through the window, so I doubt these girls and I will be hearing much for the rest of the night. None of the armed women will probably win any marksmanship awards, but they all seem to be able to dump rounds in the dark just about as well as me and my two teammates. The three with experience reload and the others run dry, and then, after I rock off my second full magazine and reload a third, Rodney calls a ceasefire. Shell casings trickle down the stairs for several seconds, but no more enemy contact returns. Just then, Carl transmits over the radio.
All call signs. I've got multiple packs fleeing on foot to the south. I'm not going to pursue. I've got this bird flying, and I don't want to fuck it up by catching more lead.
Kareem rogers up, and we begin getting the women ready to move. Now I hear a shriek behind me, and I spin around as Rodney actuates his weapon light, shining it on the floor in the direction of the noise. The tall Ukrainian who'd fielded my Kalashnikov lies on her back, her irises rolled back in her open eyes, a pair of bloody bullet holes in the center of her gown. One of the other hostages, a small Asian woman who doesn't seem to understand English, has been shot just below her right knee, and a red-headed girl in her 20s looks like she's took a ricochet to her left hip. Kareem drops to the floor next to the Asian, along with several other women, and they all work together to treat her, while Rodney pulls out his medical kit and bandages the redhead. One of the hostages is dead, and two are wounded. Anger threatens my mission, so I force myself to take a deep breath. We're going to go for a couple of those SUVs out on the driveway. We'll either find the keys or we'll hotwire the things. I don't give a shit which. Everybody is coming. We'll carry the wounded. It seems like 1,000 police lights flash in the darkness just a mile or so behind us as we race overland in a convoy of two silver Cadillac Escalades. Our headlights are off, and I'm glad I'm not behind the wheel. But soon enough, Kareem and Rodney find a back road that leads off the 60-acre ranch, and we drive it to the highway, then turn to the south, heading to Calabasas to drop the injured women off at the hospital. I make contact with Talissa and tell her what happened at Rancho Esmeralda. I hate letting her know that her sister was hauled away during the fight by Yako and the director, but I do so. I tell her to stay put down in L.A., ask her to watch as much news as she can about the shootout, and to see if she learns anything of note that might help us find out the identity of the director. She doesn't like being sidelined like this, but I finally convince her that I don't have any other plans on how to move forward, so it's not like she's missing out on anything. I've got a vague idea about going after this psychologist Talissa has identified, but in the short term it doesn't sound that promising. Even though we didn't see her tonight, we can be sure she is aware that I am here, and that makes it pretty unlikely she'll just be sitting around the house waiting for me to show up. Sooner or later, yeah, Dr. Riesling might show herself, but I don't have that kind of time. Hanley is going to send Travers and his boys to L.A. the minute he hears about the battle in the San Fernando Valley, and I'm going to get yanked back into service for the CIA. Whatever I'm going to do on this up, I figure I have about 12 hours to get it done before I'll be ducking Ground Branch. The two Escalades drive on through the early morning, me, two other men, and nine women, with not one of us knowing what the hell happens next. Ken Cage sat in the back of the Mercedes SUV, his heart sending sharp pains through his chest as he worried about everything that was falling apart around him. He held a phone to his ear and it rang and rang. Cage cursed at the delay until finally a sleepy woman's voice answered.
Ken?
Listen to me, Heather. I need you to wake up.
What time is it?
Don't ask any questions, please. I need you to get the kids and get out of the house, now. There's a little mix-up and it won't be for long, but Sean feels it's safer if...
What's going on?
Cage looked across the vehicle at Maya, who just stared back at him with blank eyes. He wanted to move to her and choke the life from her, but Yako had stopped him from doing so once already, insisting that she was important leverage to use against the gray man. So Cage refocused his attention on his wife. "Heather," he continued, "I'll have to explain everything later, but..."
"What have you done?"
"Done? I haven't done..." Heather was fully awake now, and she screamed in anger, not in panic.
"What have you done?"
He answered her in a meek voice. "Nothing. I didn't do anything."
"I don't know what you do, and I don't know who you do it with, and I don't really care. But you and I have built something, and you are not going to fuck it up."
"It's just work, babe. It's not..."
"Bullshit!"
Cage's wife screamed.
"You are a criminal, and I'm not talking about cooking the books. You've been doing that for 20 years, but whatever you're into now, it's changed you. Look, you can be gone as long as you want. You can fuck whoever or whatever you want while you're gone. I can't stop you. But you keep that shit away from me and the kids, and you keep us in the life you've given us. You are not going to take that away. Nobody is going to take that away from us. Do you understand me?"
Cage bit his lower lip, thought about his next words carefully. "I'm doing my best to keep you out of any danger. Sean wants you to leave the house just for a day or two, while he and Yako take care of things. Please do this for me, honey." Heather Cage breathed into the phone for a few seconds, and Ken sat there listening, his eyes closed.
"Charlotte isn't here. She's up in Arrowhead at the Ambertons' lake house."
"Call her. Tell her to stay right there."
"She's not going to answer her phone in the middle of the night, Ken."
"Call her anyway. Do that. Then take Justin and Juliet and go."
"Go where? The beach house?"
"No. Don't go to one of our properties." He thought a moment. "It's almost 1 a.m. Just go get a hotel. I don't care where, but text me when you know where you'll be. This will all be over and I'll come." Heather hung up the phone. Cage handed the device back to Sean. "They're leaving." Sean had been listening in to the conversation. "Charlotte's in Arrowhead, right?" "Yeah, she's fine." Cage then looked again to the girl he first met a month ago in a nightclub in Bucharest. He said, "So, all this is about you. Doesn't that make you feel special?" She turned away from him, gazed out the window. His voice turned both sinister and sexual. "You thought things were tough before. Now I'm really gonna punish you, and I'm going to love every second of it." He smiled. "Yako says we have to keep you alive. Anything else that happens to you is at my discretion, and you'll pay dearly for this shit." The Romanian woman said nothing. Cage leaned forward close to her face. "I will fuck you up, and I'll start today. By the time I'm finished with you, you won't want to go home. You'll want Yako to fucking kill you to make the nightmare stop."
"You are the devil,"
Maya said.
"You bet I am, little girl."
Cage reached out, took her by the throat, and squeezed. Sean Hall sat in the row in front of Cage and Maya, but he was still turned back in their direction. He grabbed his employer's arm and pulled it away. "Keep your head in the game, Ken. We have to leave her in one piece to use her as insurance. She's important." Cage shrugged away from his bodyguard's grip, but he kept his malevolent eyes on the kidnapped woman, a cruel sneer of a smile on his face.
"You just wait, bitch. You just wait."
51. Carl and AJ land, refuel, and patch up the helicopter on a darkened tarmac at Bakersfield Municipal Airport. They roll Shep Duval's corpse into a couple of thick contractor bags and tape them together, creating a poor man's body bag. And then AJ takes a cab back to the house to retrieve his truck. He returns with it, loads Shep's lifeless body into the back, and then drives it to the parking lot of a hospital. Here, he gently lays it under a tree at the edge of the lot, in sight of the emergency room. After a prayer over his fallen friend, he drives back to the airport, where he and Carl drink coffee and wait, hoping like hell for another chance to go after the director. The rest of us make it back to Rodney's place in Bakersfield at 3:30 a.m. We've treated Kareem's shoulder,
and he's doing okay, but bitching constantly about letting the mastermind of the entire consortium get away. It's annoying, but I get it. I am bitching just as much as he is, and I didn't even get shot. The hostages are racked out on the floor all over the place. Most are still in a state of shock, but every one of them seems happy to be free from captivity, which is a relief, because I thought it possible, even after all the horrors these girls have undoubtedly suffered, that a few of them at least would side with their captors. Some demand to speak to their embassy, but most understand that they are in the middle of a very fluid, if very low-rent, operation, and they calm the most anxious down. They all promise to sit tight, and we promise them we will help them get where they need to go soon. Me and the boys grab more ammo and smoke grenades from Rodney's garage, and we're in the process of cleaning our weapons when Talissa calls me from down in L.A. I step into the backyard for some privacy, thinking she's going to light into me about failing again to rescue her sister, probably because it's all I'm thinking about right now myself. But instead, she says,
"Gentry, the director will wonder how we found out about the ranch. He'll be worried, at least for a few days, that we can trace the property directly to him somehow."
I hope she's right about this. Suits me if he's running scared.
"Men like this," she says, "wealthy, powerful men, they have a lot of places they can flee to in times of danger."
Sure. I've known a few powerful assholes myself, and she's correct about their modus operandi when dealing with trouble. She says,
"If I knew about other properties he owned, we might have something to go on, but Rancho Esmeralda was so well insulated in its corporate ownership that I can't tie any person to it."
"I know all this already. What's your point?"
"My point is he is going to leave the area, soon, if he hasn't already."
"Yeah, of course, Dr. Riesling as well. But what can we do about it? There are a lot of airports here. We can't just go..."
"Where do you think the director lives?"
This question surprises me. I have no idea.
"You know it's within driving distance to the ranch because he brought my sister all the way here from Romania for himself."
"Right, but 10 million people live within 2 hours of that location."
"The director doesn't live like 10 million people."
"This is true. But still, lots of enclaves for the wealthy around here. Not just in L.A., but in towns up the coast as well." Talissa says,
"He's a businessman, a financier. He won't be in some beach town hours away from Los Angeles. He's got to be in the city. He meets clients for lunch. He needs the convenience of L.A.
I don't have a clue where she's going with this. Okay, he's in L.A., some ritzy part of it. What, do we go door to door and knock?
"Of course not. But you and your team shouldn't sit up there in a house in Bakersfield either. Come down here. If my sister is able to alert me some way, if she is even still alive and still with the director, then you will be much closer when it happens."
It's a lot of ifs, but Talissa is right. L.A. is the most high probability location for the director. And if we head down in that direction now, we will be able to act faster if, by some miracle, Roxana is able to get a message out. 20 minutes later, Kareem, Rodney, AJ, and I have left the kidnapping victims alone at Rodney's place, and we drive in AJ's truck to the south. Carl is still at the airport with his helicopter, but when we tell him what we're doing, he decides to fly it to Van Nuys Airport in the San Fernando Valley. That will put him just minutes flying time from anywhere in L.A., and it also gives the rest of us a place to position ourselves. This may not be much, but it feels like forward momentum to me, if only incremental forward momentum. But one thing feels certain. I got us to Venice, and Talissa got us to Rancho Esmeralda. But if we're going to find our way to the top of this evil organization in the next 12 hours, it's up to Roxana. Roxana Vaduva drank the tepid vodka straight out of the little bottle while the men around her discussed whether to kill her. Three men held her fate in their hands, and all three of them were aware of who she was and what she had done. They knew she'd been sent by her sister to meet the director, and then, once she'd been taken, she'd communicated with her sister's colleague on the yacht, no doubt giving him the information that led him to Italy. So now she sat quietly,
took a last gulp to finish the bottle, and awaited their decision. The man she knew as the director stormed around the massive penthouse hotel suite, hands on his hips, a bathrobe covering his small frame. The tall, bald-headed man named Yako sat on a sofa in the opposite corner, making phone call after phone call. And Sean, the director's bodyguard, sat quietly on the kitchen counter, just feet from Roxana. She'd seen him sneak an airplane vodka bottle out of the minibar for himself. He was clearly scared. He wasn't as scared as Roxana, no. She didn't think anyone on Earth was as scared as she was right now. But she could tell he wanted nothing more to do with this entire affair, and the one shot of vodka she'd seen him down so far would help him no more than the one she just drank would aid in getting her out of this mess. Dr. Claudia was also in the penthouse now. The older American woman's normally calm exterior had given way to an intense look of concern, nail-biting, and chain-smoking. Whoever it was who had shown up at the ranch in a helicopter, they had certainly rattled the top of the consortium. It had to have been the assassin from the yacht, although he certainly must have brought more forces along with him. She hoped like hell her sister had been nowhere near all that fighting. She assumed Talissa was still in Europe, directing the actions of the American killer from there. Roxana looked at Yako now, and he at her. His eyes frightened her, and she turned away, wondering if he might just draw the gun out from under his jacket and shoot her in the head. That was ultimately the director's call, she was certain, and this terrified her more. If she was the most afraid in the room, the small, bald-headed man was the angriest. His pacing, his yelling at his subordinates, his taking of pills, and his occasional bouts of brooding silence had made the last few hours a terrifying rollercoaster ride for the young Romanian. The director stormed around now, and she focused on him. She thought at first that he looked like Napoleon at Waterloo, but after watching him for a while, she found him to be less like the embattled general and more like a spoiled kid, furious things weren't going his way. She tried to put the terror out of her mind and think of the positives. It had been a horrific night, but there was something positive in all this. She knew exactly where she was, Los Angeles. On the drive-in, she'd seen the interstate signs giving directions to Hollywood, and then, after they got off the interstate, the street signs told her she was in Beverly Hills. When they'd pulled up to this building, she saw one last sign before she'd been whisked inside, the Four Seasons Hotel. If she could just find access to a phone or get online somehow, she could contact her sister and tell her the director was right here with her. It was too late to save her, Roxana was certain. They would kill her soon enough, no matter what she did. But if she could only get the information out before she was murdered, she might be able to help all the other women held in bondage by this horrible organization. The director stopped pacing and looked out the window a moment. Then, his plaintive voice kicked up again at something Yako said that Roxana could not hear. The American said,
"I'm not leaving the U.S. Why the hell should I? The government is watching out for me here, and I don't have a single personal tie to what happened at Rancho Esmeralda."
Yako replied in a strikingly calmer manner.
"A week, Ken. Two, maybe. We go down to Antigua or to Costa Rica. Work from your property there. Make sure that everything here is cleaned up and this fucking gentry bloke is dealt with."
Sean started to second Yako's proposal, but Cage shouted over him.
"How's that going to happen? You've lost all your men but two, and you haven't put a scratch on him as near as I can tell. There were 30 cartel soldiers on that property. 30! And still we hear that the men who attacked escaped in their helicopter, along with the merchandise, I might add. Expensive fucking merchandise, each one of whom has seen very important faces around here. Do you have any idea what this will do to every man who's gone to Esmeralda? They're all gonna come at me now. Studio heads, financiers, high-profile lawyers. I don't have to remind you the power of our clientele, do I? All the more reason for you to get out of the country while we get to work cleaning this up. Look, the American government is actively trying to kill the gray man. He's in the U.S., they know it. And now they will know what area he's in. That aspect of this problem will clean itself up in short order. Either he runs away or they get him.
You just have to be clear of the area until one of those two things happens.
The director sat down now, the first time Roxana had seen him do so since his arrival here at the Four Seasons. He closed his eyes and rubbed them with his hands, his elbows on his knees, the cuffs of his blue bathrobe drooping, exposing his hairy forearms.
I've got so much shit at the house that I can't leave without. Bearer bonds, hard drives, physical stuff. I'll send Sean and his men to get it all.
Sean began to protest this. Roxana knew he'd refuse to leave his boss's side, but Cage said,
If I'm leaving the country, then I'm going by the house first. Sean's not getting in my safe. Only I go in my safe.
Yako stood now, looked out over the balcony at the morning.
How much time will you need?
This time, Sean did break into the conversation.
Wait, you aren't suggesting he actually go to his residence? We don't know if Gentry and his people know his address, his name. Shit, I'm not sending him into...
Yako pointed at the American bodyguard.
You'll do your job!
He turned to Ken now.
How much time, boss?
I need 2 hours, and I need Sean's men to help me load up cars.
If I tell my wife we're leaving the country and she can't go home first, she's going to do more damage to me than Court Gentry.
He leaned back on the sofa.
Shit! Heads are going to roll when this is over. I swear to you both!
Yako spoke to Sean.
2 hours? The seven of you can watch him. Me, Lutz, and Diker too. That's 10 armed men there. Claudia can help as well.
Sean looked defeated to Roxana, but he didn't give in completely.
1 hour. We go in hard and fast, all of us together, and my men are on watch while me and the four of you help the boss get what he needs.
Claudia had not said a single word, but now she spoke up.
I can pack Heather's clothes, get the kids' stuff, while you are dealing with potential evidence.
Ken just nodded and rubbed his eyes some more, then took his hands away and again looked right at Roxana.
What about her?
Yako didn't hesitate.
She comes with us. If Gentry and his mates arrive, I'll have a knife at her neck to slow them while you get away. If he makes contact with us, we'll use her to bargain. Or as bait.
Roxana's teeth chattered, but through the fear, she recognized that she was about to go to the home of the director, ground zero of the consortium. She didn't see this as yet a new danger. No, this was her chance, her last chance, and she knew it. 52. 16-year-old Charlotte Cage stepped out of the kitchen door of her girlfriend's house in Bel Air, then walked down the driveway as the gate opened automatically in front of her, thumbing open her phone screen along the way. With a couple of clicks, she ordered an Uber Lux to take her to her home in the Hollywood Hills, 15 minutes away in morning traffic. She wasn't supposed to be here. Her mom routinely disallowed her daughter from overnighting with her 18-year-old friend, thinking Clara to be a bad influence, so Charlotte had quit asking permission. Instead, she told her mom she was spending a couple of days at Lake Arrowhead with a friend her own age, whom her mom trusted. This wasn't the first time this summer she'd pulled this off, and she hoped it wouldn't be the last. As Charlotte stood there waiting for her ride, she noticed she'd missed a text message and a phone call. The text was from her mom, and it was demonstrative and unusual, but not particularly worrisome. Call me as soon as you get this. Do not under any circumstances go to the house. She didn't bother listening to the voicemail. As she climbed into the back of the BMW 5 Series that arrived to pick her up, Charlotte considered calling to see what was going on, but she decided against it. She also decided against complying with her mother's wishes. She was only leaving the house so early this morning because she was meeting Sean for a surfing lesson. Sean didn't work Wednesday mornings, and they'd made plans the week before. She hadn't said anything to him about Arrowhead, knowing all the time she'd be in town and excited to go surfing. Charlotte told herself she'd wait to reach out to her mom till she and Sean got to Santa Monica with their surfboards, and she'd tell her she'd caught a ride from Arrowhead early this morning. As the Uber drove through the narrow, winding streets in the Hollywood Hills, she told the driver to drop her off at the house next door to hers, not wanting her mom or dad to see her.
From there, she walked to a locked gate in the fence around her 2-acre property, punched in the code, and let herself in. Closing it behind her, she headed down the steeply graded drive, then turned and moved across the sloping landscaped yard on the offhand chance her mom was standing at the living room window that overlooked the driveway. She made her way around to the back of the property right at 7 a.m., hoping no one in the house could see her as she rapped on the door to the pool house. But when Sean didn't answer,